And Ron is traveling and was hoping to join us by webcast today, but that we've had technical difficulties, so we're hi Ron. We're going to film it instead, or tape it, or digitize it in some way. Instead, and so in Ron's absence, I have the great pleasure of being the one who introduces Maya, who, except for first-year people and a few visitors, probably needs no introduction. Maya's in her fifth year in the SOCHDMOD program, and she's been in Egypt on and off over the last several years, but is here today to present us new results on one of her dissertation papers, The Life Course Perspective on Social Protection Among Working Poor in Egypt, and I won't take up any more of your time. Maya Stevedy.
I am, as Mike said, a fifth year in the SOCHDMOD program. I also, while I'm in Cairo, I'm working for the Poverty, Gender, and Youth program for the Population Council's office in Egypt. And the paper I'm going to present is part of a multi-method project that the council is doing on social protection. It overlaps with a lot of my dissertation issues, but I'm trying also to fit in with their framework. The team that's working on this is basically me and three labor economists. So I'm trying to push this paper into a more sort of demographic perspective on some of the issues and not get totally sucked into the economics literature on informality. So this is a fairly preliminary analysis of the fieldwork, and I particularly appreciate any comments on how people think I can move this sort of into our discipline a little bit more and out of my disciplinary mix. So I'll get started. What is social protection? This is basically the new development speak promoted in particular by the World Bank for social safety nets, which was a concept that was very widely promoted in the era of structural adjustment programs starting in the 1990s. The idea of the social safety net basically being, as it sounds like, a means to catch the people who are really in abject poverty, sort of a means provision for those who are, in particular, losing jobs and suffering from rising prices under structural adjustment. The concept of social protection is now being pushed by a lot of the development agencies as sort of a new and improved version of the social safety net that isn't focusing just on poverty alleviation, but on reducing risk and vulnerability among, in particular, the poor and those who are sort of right above the poverty line. Being a sort of new and development concept, social protection is not particularly well defined. You will find most sources give it a different content anything you read. The two basic categories that I'm going to talk about here are social assistance or social transfers. Examples of this are subsidies, welfare, or child maternal benefits that are not based on employment. And the sort of new development catchphrase after microfinance, conditional cash transfer, which basically provides poverty alleviation or some kind of subsidies for families who are conforming to certain things that the government or the NGO wants them to do. The other major category is social insurance, which is employment-based benefits, pensions, social security, unemployment benefits, disability, these kinds of things. Some sources will include in social protection things like health and safety standards, labor standards, microfinance, a whole sort of catch-all of things. But I'm going to try and stay away from those today. The Middle East and North Africa, sorry, I didn't write out my abbreviation, is a region that's sort of new to this literature on social protection, which in the developing world tends to be very tied in with literature on informality. The literature in this area is fairly developed in Latin America. There's been a lot of studies of labor market dynamics and social protection schemes in Latin America, but in the MENA region, it's fairly new. Some of the reasons why we're interested in looking at this is that the poverty rate in the Arab region is really quite high. It's 40% based on national poverty lines. This obviously varies quite a lot across the region. We have a number of very wealthy countries and a number of very poor ones. Egypt is on the poorer end. The poverty rate's about 41%. Most of these countries, Egypt included, have really what are quite extensive social protection schemes. There are a lot of mechanisms in place to try and support families and households that are at or below the poverty line. But these systems, most of them have been in place since the 1960s, 1950s, when Arab socialism spread across the region, led by Egypt's Nasser. And so the systems are in place, but they haven't been, the level of resources that's being put into them hasn't risen as much as population growth has, so these systems have become very strained. They're there because governments are afraid to take them away. They're very politically sensitive. But the quality of services and the extent to which it's actually reaching people is a question that's become increasingly important and increasingly unknown. Another issue is that social protection coverage through employment, which in most developing countries is how most people get social protection. We have pensions that are attached to our jobs. Labor market participation in MENA is quite low, particularly among women. I think the regional figure is about 35% of women are in the labor force. In Egypt, it's 27%. So you have a large number, or a large portion of the population, particularly women, who aren't getting any kind of pension based on employment. And among the people who are employed, coverage by social insurance and social security has been declining. Public sectors in the Middle East, and particularly in Egypt, used to employ a large percentage of the population. Starting in the 1950s, if you graduated from a vocational secondary school or a university in Egypt, you were guaranteed a public position. In the beginning of this, yeah, it's a pretty nice deal, huh? And you went to school for free. Education was free, and then they guaranteed you a job. Back in the good old days, it took a year or two to wait for those jobs. By the time you got to the 1980s and the 1990s, when the proportion of the population who actually graduated from university was many times what it was in the 60s, people would wait for 10 to 12 years for their government appointment, it's called. In the early 2000s, they just completely stopped the program. So public employment, in the sense of the permanent job security and the contracts and all the benefits that we associate with public employment in most places, no longer exists. At the same time, the formal private sector hasn't really been growing very fast in Egypt. Something like 10 or 12% of employment is in the formal private sector, meaning that people have contracts, social security, all these kinds of things. Everybody else has gone into the informal economy, particularly young people. About 61% of employment is now in the informal sector. In Egypt, they generally define informality by having no contracts and no social security. So the majority of people, they just have some kind of oral agreement between them and their employer, or they're running their own shop. They don't contribute to social security, a lot of them don't pay taxes, they don't have bookkeeping, and then if your boss gets sick of you, you're kind of out and you have to work. As you can see, I just ran a very quick crosstab of the percentage of the employed who are registered with social insurance. You can see that among the older generation, people who are now approaching retirement age, in their 50s and 60s, 60% of men and 43% of women have social insurance coverage. So even among these older generations, you have a fairly large number of people who are working but will not get a pension when they leave the labor market. Among the 20 to 30-year-olds, that's gone down to the 30%, particularly among men. These statistics kind of make it look like women are doing better in the labor market. I think that's not actually the case. What it means is that men, because they're generally household providers, will take any job, regardless of the conditions that they're offered. Women, rather than taking a job where they're not having a contract in social security, will stay home. And I'll get into this a little bit more when I talk about the results. But this is just sort of a general overview of the fact that a very low percentage of young workers these days are likely to be getting any sort of employment-related pension when they get older age. So the question is what this really means at the household level. The issue of the determinants of who is getting social protection and who has access in these sort of labor market dynamics are being addressed in some of the quantitative papers that are related to this project. What I'm trying to do in this paper is actually look qualitatively at how people think about social protection and social safety nets and supporting themselves in those periods of life when they're not working. Because there's a couple of reasons to think that this may be either we're sort of heading for catastrophe here with a large number of people who are not going to have any way to support themselves, or that there may actually be other mechanisms in place by which people are supporting their families and expect to support their families, so that they're not putting that much importance on social protection, or that we don't have to worry about it that much. Some of the international literature, again, none of this is based on the Middle East, is that workers and the self-employed may actually prefer to save their money than to spend it on contributing to public social protection schemes. This is particularly the case in developing countries where the reliability and the quality of the service that you're getting is not that good. You can also compare this to the issue of Social Security in the States, where maybe we're not sure if when we hit retirement age, some of us, Social Security will still be there. So if you don't think that the public pension system is going to be there, then contributing now is throwing your money away. Health insurance services, or health insurance, the hospitals you're able to go to if they're public hospitals, which is often the case in Egypt, may not be very good. People may not want to go there, so they would rather save their money and spend it on private clinics rather than putting it into public insurance that they won't use. Unemployment benefits, these kinds of things, the programs are very hard to access, so people would rather not pay out their contributions. Another issue is that the benefits may be shared within households, so that you only really need one member who has access to the formal systems. So when we see numbers related to social protection coverage, and we see fairly small numbers, like I was just showing, 50% of older workers have social protection, this may be going a lot further than you think it is, because these benefits are being shared within households. Sort of similar to, in the States, how if your parent is employed and has health insurance that covers their kids, right? Social insurance benefits may be working in a similar sort of way. And another issue that's particularly important in contexts where a lot of people live in extended families, which is the case in Egypt, is that informal social networks are being used to spread income around. And so people are a lot less concerned about how they're going to support themselves than they might be in a developing country. So the research questions for this project are, how do poor households rely on social protection schemes to supplement or replace labor income? How do the unemployed and those who are out of the labor market access social protection? And how have access and reliance on social protection changed with the increasing privatization of the labor market? So particularly the last question, the methodology was structured to do a generational comparison between those groups that I just showed you statistics for. Young adults who are 20 to 30, so in the age of finishing our education and entering the labor market, this population has been of particular interest on the literature on informality in Egypt because of the very high unemployment rate among youth. Young people, the overall unemployment rate in Egypt is about 8%. It's 4% among men and about 20% among women. Among young people, it's well over 20% for both males and females. And there's a lot of evidence that the way young people get into the labor market these days is by taking an informal job and then moving from informal job to informal job in an event or in an attempt to eventually get some kind of secure status. So we're focusing mainly on that generation, and then as a comparison point, I added interviews with adults who are at or approaching retirement age, so 50 to 65. There were two study sites in Cairo and then in Enna, which is a government in Upper Egypt. We focused on rural areas to try and get a comparison with an urban Cairo because the functioning of social safety nets is very different in rural areas. The generational comparison and like the older adult section was more interesting, I think, than I expected. So I'm thinking about going back to Anna to add some older adults in that area as well. So I'd appreciate comments on whether you think that's worthwhile. The sample was structured basically on a quota sampling in qualitative research. So we set a certain number of people we wanted based on age, gender, and then whether or not they were involved in the labor market. So we set out to find a group of people who were working public sector, a group of people in the formal private sector, and formal private, in order to get a comparison of social protection access and how people think about it. Socioeconomically, the paper is supposed to focus on the working poor, which is not a particularly rigorous statistical definition of who's poor. Operationally, what I did is try to focus on households for whom the amount of money you get from social protection payouts or social insurance payouts in Egypt, which is somewhere between $20 to $120 a month, is actually going to make a difference in your household welfare. And that's a fairly large population in Egypt, particularly in Cairo. In rural areas, that is much lower. But $20 goes a decent way in Egypt. It's well below the poverty line, but that's generally the amount of money that you would get from social assistance programs. So the majority of people we talk to are 5 to 6 person households living in generally 4-room apartments in areas of Cairo that are known as, they call it popular, the transition is popular areas, which is basically the additional for like working class or lower working class. A number of them are actually in slum areas. There's a lot of informal housing development in Cairo, which are areas where they get very little access to public services. And then in Anna, the rural areas are largely agricultural.
Sorry,
Maya.
Yes,
just
one individual per household that you...
Yeah, there were sometimes I interviewed multiple people in extended households if they were heads of different types of protection schemes, but yeah, it was I'm going to give a quick overview of the social assistance programs in Egypt that we talked about. A major one is subsidies on basic goods, sugar, oil, bread, petrol, which are heavily subsidized in Egypt. They're extensively subsidized and not efficiently targeted. Basically, anybody can get subsidized goods, even if you don't need them. It's a highly politicized issue in Egypt. They tried to reduce bread subsidies explicitly once in the 70s, and the country broke out in riots. So ever since then, the government has sort of sneakily been lowering the subsidy and raising the cost of things. I'm not going to get into those here because it's a whole different literature, but basically, for the households we were talking about, these kinds of subsidized goods were extremely important to them. And they were all very attached to the idea of having subsidized goods available rather than actually having more money. This is something that they're really very used to depending on. Conditional cash transfer is something that's just been starting in Egypt. There's a pilot program in one of the governorates in Upper Egypt where they'll give families money conditional on sending all of their children to school, particularly the girls. There is an evaluation of this that should come out in the next year or two, but it hasn't been done yet, so I'm very curious to see how that went. The other form of social assistance is welfare pensions. The word they use for it translates basically to the social guarantee. Technically, I think anybody who has below a certain amount of income can apply for them, but we found in interviews that are very widely perceived to be for widows or for other women who really have no, like absolutely no male provider. And the families that I spoke to were, even though working class and a lot of them were quite poor, they all said, no, that's for like really poor people. Like, we're not. I mean, we're talking about families who are living on maybe $50 a month. And they didn't perceive themselves to be poor to the extent that they were willing to go apply for the social assistance. So there's a definite sense of like shame in applying for it, and also a very strong perception that you're not eligible to begin with if you're unless you're a widow.
So $50 per month for the whole household or per capita? So per capita, that's less than $1 a day.
Yeah, it's well under $1 a day. The welfare pensions, they just raised them to £139 a month, which is about $23 a month. And that's going to the household. So yeah, it's well under $1 a day. And another really common form of these sort of welfare pensions is assistance from the mosque. A lot of people from very poor families get assistance from the mosque for their kids. And you get £20 per kid, which is basically $4 or $5 a month.
Let's all turn off our phones.
I didn't know I had it. So we're talking about really very small amounts of money that are coming out of these programs. Social insurance, I think, is what I focused on in these interviews and in this paper. Interestingly enough, I didn't know this before I started this project, Egypt is one of 3 countries in Africa that has unemployment insurance. The other 2 are Algeria and South Africa. Although these technically exist, nobody knows that they do. Everybody I talked to said, oh yes, unemployment benefits, they started talking about that after the revolution. They want to start them. And if you mention to people that they actually exist, people are quite convinced that they don't. The requirements for getting unemployment benefits, this is probably why, are extremely complicated. You have to, in addition to having contributed before you became unemployed, go register with the Ministry of Manpower office and do certain other things. Basically, they seem to practically not exist. And interestingly enough, most people thought they were a bad idea. Pretty much everyone we talked to, except a couple of young men who were sort of like in and out of unemployment, thought that Egyptians would cheat. They're like, everybody will cheat. They'll find ways to stay on the program without actually being unemployed. And there was really very little support for the idea, interestingly enough. Health insurance is really not very widespread. It's basically available to people who work in the public sector. And in this, I found what they found in a lot of the Latin American literature, that the public sector health insurance means you have to go to public hospitals and public clinics, which are generally of very poor quality. And most of the people who had the insurance didn't actually use it. They would pay to go to private clinics. And the medicine benefit, a lot of the older people would complain that it didn't cover enough of their prescriptions. So basically, people didn't find it that important. They thought the idea was nice in the abstract, but nobody really used it. Some formal private sector workers, people who have the good jobs and big companies that have actually follow labor regulations, did actually get decent health insurance and were very happy with it. Maternity leave kind of works the same way. I really had my heart set on doing another paper about maternity leave, but it's just not enough people have it. basically, maternity leave, the benefits are really generous. You get 3 months of full pay. And if you work in an establishment that employs 50 or more people, you can take 2 years of unpaid leave, and your employer is not allowed to fire you. Something I'm sure we would all love to have. It's very common in the government. Most of the older women I talked to who worked in the government had taken this 2 or 3 times. I think there's a cap on 3 kids. So you can't take it for more than 3 kids. In the private sector, some formal firms have it. They don't really give the 2 years, even if they're supposed to. And most people just don't get it. I met one woman, a young woman who was on maternity leave. She worked for a tourism company. And she started maternity leave right before the revolution happened. So when she went to get her 3 month check, they told her, they gave her half her salary. And she said, no, I was supposed to get my whole salary. And they said, you're on maternity leave, be happy with what you're getting. And since then, this was about 5 months later, she'd been sitting at home getting no maternity benefits, but they hadn't actually fired her yet. So that was my paper. Didn't go very far. in terms of social insurance, this is what I'm going to focus on the rest of the paper. This is basically Social Security. Because this is the one thing I found that actually a lot of people seem to have access to. I'm going to bore you with a couple of the details of how this works, because I think it actually matters to the analysis later on. Egypt has a very poorly structured social security system. It's a defined benefit pay-go system. I'm sure if Ron were here, he would have lots of things to say about that. Your total contribution is really high. It's 40% of salaries, 14% paid by the employee, and 26% by the employer. So right here is why a lot of employers don't like to cover their employees. To qualify for a pension, this is really convoluted. It took me a long time to figure it out. You have to have made 120 months of contributions and retire after age 60, so 10 years, or 2 years worth of contributions and retire after age 50. However, once you... 20 years, yeah, and retire after 50. If there's a couple of ways you can retire early and have your benefit reduced, but I don't understand them. But once you pass this post, it doesn't, the first, 18 years of service don't actually count towards calculating your benefit. Your benefit, the actual amount of money that you get, is calculated based on your last 2 years of work, 2 years of salary in the public sector, and your last 5 years in the private sector. Yeah. So they passed a law a couple of years ago trying to move this to an individual account system. It was supposed to be implemented by early 2012, but the revolution has indefinitely stalled that, and it doesn't really seem to be happening. But basically, given this way that this works, is what a lot of people do is the employers will either underreport salaries to the social insurance agency. If you're actually making £1,000 a month, your employer might report 200 or 250. This gets them away from the social insurance agent, like the people who come and check for labor regulations if they don't feel like bribing them, which is what most people do. It reduces the amount the employer pays, it reduces the amount the employee pays, and actually the employee doesn't really have much incentive to care until it's your last 2 to 5 years of working, at which point you actually care how much of your salary is being reported. So most people who were working who had this underreporting going on didn't really care, except that the salary that's registered at social insurance is your legal salary. And so if I'm registered at £250 a month, but technically making 1,000, if my employer decides, oh, we're having a bad year because of the revolution, the borrowing is down, whatever, he can just cut my salary to £300, and I have no legal recourse because I'm registered at 250. And this was something that I found actually with a lot of people, especially in the economic climate that Egypt has now. Another interesting thing about the way pensions work in Egypt is that they're inheritable, which is also the case here. If you're a dependent under 18 and one of your parents is supporting you and they pass away, you can inherit their social security benefits. But in Egypt, inheritance is based basically on the ideal of male providership. So if you have a dependent son or a brother, he can inherit and you pass away while you have a pension or the right to a pension. He can inherit until he's 21 or 26 if he's a student, or permanently if he's disabled. Your daughters and your sisters can inherit your pension forever as long as they're not married. This includes if they get married and get divorced. I interviewed one woman who was married and trying to divorce her husband, and one of her complaints with him holding up the divorce was the fact that she can't take her father's pension, which was a major form of support for her, until the divorce papers actually went through. But she was in her early 30s. When she got divorced, she could keep that pension forever as long as she didn't remarry. The same is true for wives. Dependent wives, you just inherit your husband's salary, your husband's pension. There's some sort of reduction if you're working, but even if you're working full-time and getting a full salary, you can still inherit your husband's pension. If the wife passes away, the husband can only inherit the pension if he's unable to work. So basically, the system, yeah?
So if I was inheriting a pension and I was of marital age, I feel like I would be like to my spouse or person I want to marry, hey, let's not get married, let's just like live on this. So does that happen or?
It doesn't, because marriage, there's such a strong social pressure to get married in Egypt that no one is willing to give up marriage for the amount of money we're talking about. being legally married is extremely important in Egypt. If it was a state, that would totally happen. Yeah, that they're
God or whatever.
Yeah,
actually legally.
Yeah, you have to actually legally be married. Otherwise, your children are illegitimate, and you face a lot of social pressure. There's all kinds of things, like bad things that happen. And the whole sort of social system is based on the idea of male providership. I mean, the ideal, if not the reality, is that there is no woman who doesn't have a male provider, regardless of whether or not she's working. So this pension system is really sort of structured in that same idea, in that if your male provider is no longer around, you should be able to inherit their benefits in order to be able to live. So what I'm gonna go through, this is my attempt to make this demographic, you can tell me whether or not I've succeeded, is sort of an ideal typical view of access to and reliance on social protection over the life course for these two generations, young women and young men, and older women and older men. This is based both on what people actually said, what actually happened to people, and I asked a comparative question in all of these interviews about how employment and social protection and these sort of social safety nets have changed over the last two generations. And almost universally, you get a very sort of nostalgic view of the good old social system in the 60s and 70s, where everybody was provided for by the system from the time you entered school until the sort of cradle to grave welfare systems. And then the breakdown of this system is a very prominent source of conversation in Egypt, and the way a lot of people think about the labor market and how they provide for their families. So for older women, we had basically two groups, the ones who are employed or formerly employed in the public sector, and housewives. Those who were employed in the public sector were usually beneficiaries of this employment guarantee. They had vocational education, secondary education, or university degrees. They pretty much all said that back when they graduated, it was very easy to get a job. You sat at home and waited for a few years, and then you took your job. Interestingly, getting a public sector job seems to be an important issue in whether or not your husband will let you keep working. A number of the women had actually stayed home when they got married, and then their husband let them go back to the labor market once they got a public sector job, because it's so easy to balance with your kids. You have good maternity leave, you have good benefits, you go home at 2 or 3 p.m. It's very family friendly. The housewives were mostly those who, there were some who were educated and just either never wanted to work or their husbands never let them. A lot of them just had never been educated enough to have benefited from these public sector guarantees. A lot of them had finished primary and preparatory school, and that was about it. Interestingly enough, among both of these groups, there was a very high level of reliance on their husbands' pensions. The housewives either were or expected to be pretty much entirely dependent on inherited pensions. The women who were widows, this was basically their only source of income, which was very important because some of them are still raising children. there was definitely other income coming into the household for the kids who were working, although a lot of them also had kids who weren't working, and this was basically how they were supporting their family. Part of the interesting aspects of how people get these pensions is that it depends quite a bit on your sort of bureaucratic luck. It's your right to these pensions, but the bureaucracy in Egypt is notorious for being very convoluted and requiring a lot of bribes and having long processes. Some people, it took up to a year, even more, to get their husband's benefits. And in the meantime, they basically had no source of income. So they were relying on family contributions and neighbors to pay their way. So this was really a very important source of income for them. The ones who were working, a lot of the women, either were already collecting their husband's pensions while they were working, or they were expecting to collect their husband's pensions if he passed away before them. And then among widows in both categories, this was a particularly important form of support because it's basically how they were providing for their kids. The situation, I think, I didn't talk to that many older people, or we didn't talk to any older people in Enna, but I think in rural areas this is fairly different, because the older generation will have had much less access to public employment to begin with, which is how everyone's getting these pensions. Education is much lower in rural areas, there's much fewer jobs, a lot of people are still employed in agriculture, particularly among the older generation. So I think in rural areas, and this is part of why I want to go back and pull that piece out, you'll find that instead of this reliance on spreading out inherited pensions, people are relying on social safety, social networks, and getting money from extended families to sort of even out spending and consumption. The men, there's sort of less variation here. All of the men, old and young, said that it had this definite view of the good old days back in the 70s or 80s when everybody could get a job right after graduating, they waited for their appointments, they have stable public sector jobs. Most of them also have informal jobs on the side. The public sector is very secure, but it doesn't pay that much money. So both of those who are employed with insurance in their main jobs and those who are employed in the informal sector full-time, they all sort of had other jobs in the informal sector where they had income. And very few of them actually expected to rely, none of them actually expected to rely on their pensions when they hit old age. So they'll talk about retirement. And so you ask them, so how are you going to support yourself when you retire? That's one guy, for example, says, oh, no, I've lined up a job with a friend of mine. He has, you know, a school here, and I'm just going to go work for him and hope he'll buy the class or something like that. So, you know, so, but you're not really retired. You know, sit at home and enjoy yourself. No, men in Egypt don't do this. Men in Egypt don't sit home, they don't retire. Everybody sort of keeps working basically to the point where they can't, because the pension values are very low. So they rely on these sort of informal sector jobs or starting a project, like a small business, to support themselves and their families. So in a way, the informal sector is sort of serving as the social safety net rather than the actual formal pensions that people are getting. Yeah.
What's the retirement age?
So it depends on the forced retirement is at 60. Once you hit 60, the government kicks you out, which is why I think a lot of these men are working after it. You can get early retirement as early as 45, but you'll lose a lot of your money. For the younger women, this sort of split between housewives and public sector employees, you just really don't find it anymore because the public sector isn't there. So now you get women who are working in the informal sector and the women who are staying home. And then I think until marriage, there tends to be a lot of back and forth. Actually, in both Cairo and in the rural area, we couldn't find girls of this sort of working class who were employed in the formal private sector. We couldn't find them. Those are those sort of formal sector jobs in Egypt go to very well-educated young people who can speak English and have all these sorts of international skills that are just really not available to most young women of this class. Anna couldn't find any girl who was employed in the formal private sector, so finally went and interviewed one of the girls who works in an NGO that the POC Council has worked with there. And she said, so she's working on this project, and the donor requires that they have social insurance. But the donor didn't pay for the social insurance, the NGO was supposed to pay for it, but the NGO didn't have the money. So she wasn't actually formally employed. They had two contracts, one of which went to the donor and showed that they were getting social security and all this stuff. The other one was the real contract for their employment, and she wasn't actually being insured. So this
is the population council you're talking about?
No, this is an NGO that we worked with. It's not the
okay.
This is like a local NGO in the area that we worked with before. So after this, other than they might rethink that. And in Cairo, we really couldn't find anyone, except the one girl who was sort of on maternity leave but was kicked out. So among this class, even being formality and having these formal sector jobs is a very tenuous position that nobody really expects to last. So most of the young women I interviewed were sort of in and out of various informal jobs. Very low commitment to any of them, understandably. The conditions were quite bad. You don't get any benefits. Your boss can let you go any day. So while a lot of them sort of saw social protection as important in the abstract, when we talked to them about like what do you look for in a job, nobody mentioned these kinds of benefits or these kinds of security. Like they talk about treatment, being treated well by your boss, being treated well by your colleagues, if you're in a position where you have to deal with other people, like having them treat you respectfully, hours, salary, these kinds of things were sort of secondary, social protection way at the bottom of the list. So this is one example. This is really typical. So this is a girl in Enna. She gets paid £199 a month. That's about $40. This is a girl with a university degree. She teaches in a public preparatory school. Even the government these days doesn't hire formally. They give people temporary contracts. So a lot of teachers these days, they're not actually technically hired by the public school system. The government pays them per class or per year. So this girl, for example, they sever their contracts 4 months every year so that they don't have to pay us for the time when school is out and so that we don't continue for 5 years within this temporary hiring scheme so that they don't have to hire us, at which point they have to give them permanent positions of Social Security and healthcare and all these kinds of positions. So they rehire us when school year begins.
Country full of GSRs.
They have no vacations. Every day she misses work, they deduct £2 to £3. No vacations, no insurance, no pension, and they were in the process of negotiating with the school new contracts. There was a bunch of labor disputes after the revolution. Everybody took the opportunity to try and get better conditions, which is that they don't include maternity leave. One of the girls who was working in an informal establishment in Enna said that if someone gets pregnant and has a baby and wants to keep the job, they basically they sign for her, and the boss signed her as if she was at work. And the managers just kind of look the other way until she comes back because there's nothing else they can do. So this is very typical of informal sector conditions for men and women in Egypt. So understandably, a lot of the girls expecting to get married or already married and having husbands who are expected to provide for them had very low labor force commitment. Marriage was basically the major decision point deciding why to stay home. A lot of them had worked before marriage or were working before marriage, largely, I think, to leave boredom. It's a good way to go out, get things to do, feel like you've used your education. At the point of marriage, a number of them stayed home because they wanted to. Some of them stayed home because their husbands told them to. And a lot of them had this sort of, both the unmarried and the married, had a sort of ambivalent position. If I can find a nice job that's fairly close to home, and I can manage the house, then I'll take it. If not, why bother? The next question to me, anyway, was so if you don't have any kind of employment or any kind of income of your own, how are you going to take care of yourself when you're old? And everybody was basically shocked at the question. They were sort of well, my husband's going to provide for me, or his pension will provide for me, or if not, my father and my brothers will provide for me. Which, if you look at their mother's generation, kind of makes sense. I mean, a lot of their mothers who are housewives are actually being supported by their husband's pensions. But the problem for this generation, which we'll see in the next section on young men,
husbands don't have pensions, right?
Some of them didn't know. Some of them didn't know whether or not their husbands were actually insured. But a lot of them did know, and there's a lot of sort of trust in God. God will provide, and otherwise, what are we supposed to do? Kind of attitude. I mean, there's not much they can do about it, right? So it wasn't something a lot of people had thought about. In rural areas, I think the sense of being supported by your families and your husbands is a little bit stronger. There were some young women in Cairo who had thought about it, particularly the ones who were in unstable relationships or whose mothers had been in unstable relationships. But they really have very few options. So you get to the young men who all completely agree with their father's generation that they have it really bad and they can't get good jobs. And actually, I think a lot of them face much more pressure than young women because they're expected to provide for their families. So they were all in the labor market to some extent. Some of them were currently unemployed but had had informal employment. And there's a lot of mobility among this group. The few who had actually found formal sector employment, either in the public or private sector, had all worked in the informal sector before and were sort of the lucky ones who had found stable jobs. And everybody took them, even if they weren't paid that much because of that security. So a lot of the ones who are in the informal sector, I'll get to this a little bit more, the trade-off between salary and security was much more pressing for them. The young women, they would take security, they don't care what the salary is. The young men actually have to think about this quite a lot more. So then asking the young men about how they're going to provide for themselves and their families in old age, most of them just thought, I said, I don't know. But they had thought about it. They actually knew if they had mentioned those kinds of things. And a lot of them relied on the same thing that their father's generation appears to be actually doing, which is starting a small business or a project, some kind of informal sector activity to keep providing for yourself until you're unable. What the female members of the household will do if they're not working and he's no longer there, in the absence of pensions, is not really something anybody could say or talk about. And again, this, even those who had pensions or would get pensions expected to work in the informal sector through old age. In the rural areas, again, there was a stronger expectation that families and social networks will provide the support. But being the men, they're the ones who have to be contributing to these networks and either being provided for by their sons or their brothers or these kinds of things. So if we're going back to the original question of do people actually care about social insurance in these contexts, older people absolutely did. They placed a lot of value on social insurance, quality health care, this sort of old school social contract from the socialist days. There was an extremely high degree of trust in the government. Some of the literature from other countries has suggested that people don't contribute to pension schemes because they don't trust the government. It's absolutely not the case in Egypt. We sort of asked people, you know, if you have the choice to have a public pension, a private pension, or a saving, what do you think is best for you and in general? Everyone universally said that you can't save. There's no such thing as saving, right? If you put the money somewhere in a bank account, like, something's going to happen and you're going to spend it, right? Saving for old age is not a realistic thing unless you're forced to do it. They have no trust in private insurance. Like, private insurance is fairly new in Egypt. People absolutely do not trust that company is going to give them their money back. So they all think that the public sector is really the way to go. It's reliable, it's secure, it will always be there. Young people also trusted the government quite a lot. They think that these are good things to have. Contributing to public institutions or social insurance is good. But on the other hand, there was very low knowledge of how social insurance works. A lot of people didn't trust their employers to be contributing. They could trust the public sector, the government, to be holding their money. They don't necessarily trust their employers to be sending that money or to be sending the amount of money that they should. And there was a lot of sense of a trade-off with immediate income. So these are two people who actually were working in the informal sector, had the option to insure, and rejected it. So the first is a young woman who is currently unemployed was talking about her previous job, where she refused social insurance enrollment because she didn't understand what kind of benefits she could get from it. And she was only being paid, £130, and she felt like she needed this money. She said, I will get the money at the end of the year, but I thought they're just deductions and I won't see the money again. Right? So this is a lack of knowledge issue. And the second one is a young man who said his employer offered to insure him and he refused because his salary is 1,000 LE and the insurance costs 140. So he actually knew like the right amount of his contribution and all these things. He said, he's getting engaged, I have to buy an apartment, get ready for marriage, and I don't have money. So then I asked him, well, so after you get married, will you let your employer insure you? He says, no, after I get married, I'm going to need the money to support my family. If my employer wants to insure me, then he needs to raise my salary. So, in the abstract, there's a lot of sort of support for the idea. In reality, I think income needs. This was also true among some of the older men who were self-employed. We talked to three who were self-employed, three men. Two actually were insuring themselves at fairly low levels, and one couldn't because he didn't have the income. And there was another young man who was self-employed who also didn't insure himself because he didn't think it was worth it. In terms of access, I'm going to go through this last bit quickly. Again, pensions and pension inheritance So it was a very important mechanism for providing income support for those who are outside the labor force. For people who are unemployed, there's basically no income support. You have to rely on your family. This is largely for widows and other women who don't have a male provider. The amounts paid by the pensions, widely considered inaccurate or inadequate, and everybody is still working in the informal sector. So the main conclusions, the issue of pensions and providing coverage. Among this class, these inheritance of pensions, I think, actually seem quite a bit more important and more significant in terms of supporting households than the actual welfare pensions that come from the Ministry of Social Affairs, that $123 a month that I was talking about. And the sort of idea that pensions will be able to be shared in old age was very prevalent, and that's how a lot of people thought about how they'd support themselves. But the young generation basically are in households in which nobody has access to social insurance. So there are benefits that can be shared, and you sort of need one member in, but a lot of these younger households just didn't have a member in. I think also among young women, this issue, the fact that pensions can be shared, or among women in general, is a disincentive to labor force participation in some way, because you don't expect to need the sort of long-term benefits of being employed. In general, labor market instability and informality reduce the perceived value of social protection among younger workers, particularly among young men. Even those who had the option, like that young man I was just showing, of enrolling in social insurance, they don't expect to be in their jobs for very long. Labor market mobility is so high, and in the informal sector, there's such a high sense of insecurity that even if your current employer is employing you, or is insuring you rather, the next one might not. In which case, even if you've got 5 years of contributions, that money is basically thrown away. There's also very low understanding of the fact that you're, 120 months or 240 months in order to get a pension don't have to be consecutive. A lot of people thought that if they had a job for a year or two and were insured, and then had a job for a year where they weren't insured, if they then went back to a job where they were insured, those first 2 years basically didn't count. And I checked this with a lawyer, and it's actually not true. That you have to be, you just have to have the months counting, they don't have to be consecutive. On the other hand, people maintain a lot of trust in the government and the sort of ideal of having this education to retirement social welfare system, even though it's not really enough to stay. So that's how far I've gotten.
I have two questions. First one is these men who were contemplating a post-retirement project, were they making steps while they're still employed to get ready for that? Were they saving some capital so they could retail on the street or something and have something to sell?
Yeah, a lot of the older men actually were. The younger ones, not really. They're sort of in the start of their family cycle. They have kids, they have young wives, they don't have the money. The older men were. Some of them, one of them had a taxi he was already running. Another one had this sort of arrangement with his friend that he would have a job. Some of them, they had
So in a sense, that is, they are saving. The other, it could be very important, and I don't know the answer, what about home ownership?
Everybody owns their home. Almost everybody.
How did they get it?
You buy it when you get married. In order
to they do save in order to buy a home.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that people say that you can't save because families in Egypt and parents and men in particular spend massive amounts of money on marriage. There's actually another piece of my dissertation that's about that. So people do actually, they save massive amounts of money for which to buy their children apartments, get their kids married into these kinds of things, and to provide for emergencies. But this idea that you can save for old age was just something that, they didn't really think it was possible. Maybe because they see these other kinds of expenses as more immediate.
Just pulling off what you said, it's interesting, you characterize as one being more immediate, right? You also said that there's a tremendous social pressure in order to get married.
Yeah.
And in order to get married, you have a home, then this may be a basic need, right?
Yeah.
It may not be considered saving, in the sense that it's providing for a durable good that your household requires.
Yeah. I mean, getting your children married in Egypt and established in their own homes and settled before you die is the number one marker of being a successful parent. I spent a lot of time sort of hanging out in households. If you go to these households during the day, it's all women. There's no men in sight. So a lot of time there were people around who weren't being interviewed, and basically there's two topics of conversation. One is where you can get a kilo of this and that at half a pound, a couple cents cheaper than somewhere else. The other one is who's getting married to whom and how you're going to get your children married and saving the money. So they do, like, there's a massive amount of saving going on, but somehow it's not full wage.
But does that massive amount of saving, massive expenditure at marriage imply then a debt that the children then take care of the parents?
Not usually. There's no credit. There's no credit system. So,
no, but it implied, you said it works the other way. When the parents become decrepit,
then they take care of their children. Yes.
Children take care of their parents, yes. It makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah, that was definitely the case, I think, in rural areas and among some families. Interestingly enough, I think people sort of accept this as the way things should be, but a lot of the younger couples, or like the younger families, noted that their parents were helping them, because incomes are just so low at this point, and salaries are so low, that some of the younger people were actually still receiving assistance from their parents. Although the ideal is, yes, that you would pay for your parents.
But their parents aren't old enough yet, right? I mean, so it's a sort of sandwich generation scheme, it sounds like to me, where the 40 to 50-year-olds are paying in both directions, while their parents and their kids, they're supporting their parents and their kids, while the kids need the parents' contribution to get married, and the old people need need the children, the 40-something children, in order to survive because of pensions and everything.
It's possible that some of their older siblings are paying. But a lot of them also, if you ask the younger people, like, how are your parents going to support you themselves? So my parents have pensions. Like, or my dad has a pension, and that will support the family. But yeah, it's...
Are multi-generational households still common in places like Cairo?
Not in Cairo. In Cairo, what a lot of people do in order to get their kids married, is, especially in these informal housing areas, is that the parent generation will build a house and then marry all of their sons. They'll build a building, like a four-apartment building, and then marry all of their sons in the apartment. So they technically have their own apartments, but they're living in the same building. In rural areas, living with your in-laws is still very common, although perceived as undesirable.
What's the inflation rate? So part of why you can't save long term might be that what I put away today will be worthless in 5 years.
It's really high. And this is something that people complain about all the time, is the rising cost of living and inflation, which I don't actually know the numbers, but given at the levels of income we're talking about and the very, very slow rate of public sector increase and pension increase, it's extremely little money. And I think that's also why a lot of people don't expect their pensions to be able to provide for them when they have retirement.
They're not indexed. Pensions
aren't indexed. They're indexed, but not as rapidly.
Indexed in the sense it's your last 2 or 5 years
of employment.
But then it starts just, right, it just falls.
They do rate, like, the maximum pension amount has been brought up and these kinds of things, but it doesn't go up nearly as rapidly as inflation. And this, it's definitely an issue that everybody is very conscious of, is the rising cost of living.
I mean, I think you sort of answered it, but for the younger generation then, is given that there are less and less multi-generational households, what is the backup plan? I mean, is this a level C, or is there any hint as to what we think might happen?
I think they're hoping that the husbands will get eventually a formal sector job, or if the wife is one of them will get a formal sector job and then have a pension afterwards. But if not, there's definitely a lot of sort of social flows of money that happen. I know on the marriage issue, for example, a way that a lot of people pay for it is that they have, those things where everybody puts in a little bit of money and then everyone takes it out. You teach to your rotating savings, so that everyone takes it out 1 month. That's how a lot of people get their kids married. Mm-hmm. And if you ask people, like, how do people save money around here, given the rates of, the lower level of salaries, that's what everybody says. Mm-hmm. And there's a definite sense, I think some of these questions, I had a hard time with the questions of, like, okay, so, it's hard to ask people, like, okay, if everybody dies, like, what are you going to do? and there was a lot, I think, of sort of this might be because I'm a foreigner, I sort of defensiveness about, oh, in Egypt we take care of our people. Mm-hmm. Like, right? It's not like the States. Here we have social solidarity and people take care of each other and nobody starves. Which on some level I think is true. But I can't tell how much of it is, this is just really what people have thought of, and how much of it is presenting to me being a foreigner. They don't want to say, like, they feel like they have to make this case for this is how their culture works and our society works.
So isn't there also a lot of pride and expectation that in the future Egypt will rise?
Oh, yes.
That we're in the doldrums right now, and it's been my mom's whole life. But if, by the time I'm her age, it would be better.
There is. There's a definite sense of, like, the country has been on the decline and everything is kind of gone.
Oh, okay.
All these systems have sort of gone downhill, and, you know, things, the country isn't, like, the leader that it was, and we didn't provide for our people the way that it was. But there's also, at the same time, this sort of, like, narrative of progress. Part of what one of my other papers looks at is this issue of labor force participation among mothers and daughters. And even though pretty much everyone agrees that it was easier to get a job in their mother's generation, as long as you were educated, everybody is convinced that women work more now than they used to, because the culture has changed and we're more open now, and your husbands don't tell you to sit home now, even though a lot of them do. And there's this sort of, like, narrative of cultural progression, even if it contradicts some of the social facts. But, and I think there's some of this going on also.
All this data was collected before the revolution?
After. I did it in June or July.
Is
after. The Enna interviews, I actually did not go. They were collected by an interviewer who went by herself because of the security situation. I was supposed to go and then they canceled it. So I'm hoping that if I go back and do the older generation interviews, I'll actually be able to go. But in rural areas, there's a lot of, in general in the country, sort of like xenophobia and suspicion of foreigners has been on the rise. The army is kind of promoting it. And in rural areas, it's very difficult as, like, a foreigner to do that. But in Cairo, I had no problem. And people have all kinds of opinions about the revolution and what the government should focus on. A lot of people from this class are actually very against it. Because as far as they're concerned, they've seen the negative economic consequences. Their salaries have been cut, their jobs aren't stable, they perceive very wide security problems. And for them, that's really what matters, and not the sort of political ideals.
Is Enna Nubian, or is it?
No.
Okay,
it's not.
So,
it's not that far down.
So it's just rural.
It's just rural and extremely poor. Okay. It's a really poor economy. It's like a little bit more.
Yeah, I was just worried there might be an ethnic confound with the rural thing.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.